Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Banks on the broadcast today, and why, if you ask them, having a lot of cash is a bad thing. Also, another installment of Freakonomics Radio from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, committed to empowering professionals of the world with the knowledge needed to do what they do best, the knowledge effect. And by Progressive Insurance, with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on mileage and safe driving habits. Learn more at progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday. This one's the 14th of June. Good, as always, to have you with us. Once upon a time, there was a financial crisis. In the land of the world's biggest economy, big banks got into some big trouble. Governments stepped in, bailouts were delivered, and the story ended, if not happily ever after, then at least without the predicted economic collapse. And then Congress had an idea and called it the Dodd-Frank bill. They said, let's make those big banks keep more cash in-house to protect against further losses. Today, regulators approved a rule to do just that, and the banks protested, saying now they'll have less money to lend to the economy. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore delivers the moral of the story.
Anat Admati is on a quest to get big banks to admit the truth. The Stanford professor says banks have no excuse not to lend. She's especially adamant that they should keep big cash cushions to protect themselves against another financial crisis. It's a simple concept. It's just like keeping more money in your checking account so you won't go bankrupt when you pay your credit card bill. Yet it's been an uphill battle for Admati to make her point.
I couldn't be heard. There was nobody who wanted to hear it for months and months.
Admati is being heard now. FDIC Chairman Sheila Bair appointed her to a group of experts who will advise on how to prevent bank failures from bringing the financial system to its knees. Admati says big banks have become the subprime borrowers of the financial system. They use a tiny little bit of equity to take on a lot of debt. Some of their limits are pretty generous.
That's like buying a $1 million house with $30,000. It's amazing. It boggles the mind.
Banks don't like to hold cash because they have to pay taxes on it. Eric Oja, an analyst with Standard & Poor's, disputes the bank's claims that cash cushions reduce the money available to lend to business. He says a big reason that lending isn't growing is that banks have overreacted to the financial crisis. They're afraid the loans will default.
You hear a lot of anecdotal evidence that small business owners looking to expand are not able to get bank loans despite having a long and good credit history. So that points to banks probably being overly cautious.
Small and mid-sized banks have high capital requirements already. And according to Sheila Bair, they're doing a better job of lending than the big banks are. So leveling the playing field shouldn't be a bad thing. Admati says the banks are being too flip about the risk they're taking without bigger capital cushions. If they can't absorb their losses, we'll have to.
When something goes wrong, taxpayers have to bear that cost.
Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JPMorgan Chase, has been outspoken against higher capital requirements. Admati wrote a letter today to the bank's board of directors saying his reasoning was flawed. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
There is other news of trouble in Dodd-Frank land today. The financial reform bill is supposed to go fully into effect in mid-July, but the Commodities Futures Trading Commission announced this morning that it wants to delay some new rules governing the $600 trillion derivatives market till year's end. Derivatives, if you have managed to put them out of your mind, are things like credit default swaps, the financial gizmos that were at the heart of the crisis just a couple of years ago. And today's slide in getting new regulations into place isn't the first time. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Already, government agencies have missed 28 deadlines for getting out new regulations.
The complexity is just enormous.
Lawrence Baxter teaches financial law at Duke University, and he says there's a lot of lobbying going on.
Large banks, small banks, investment banking have opposed a number of the rules in an effort simply to ensure that they are not as severe as have been expected, cutting back on, you know, major sources of revenue in the interests of financial stability and reduced risk.
Our goal here is not to slow down or water down. That's a red herring.
That's Scott Talbot of the Financial Services Roundtable, an industry trade group. Bankers complain that some draft rules are burdensome and costly.
And so if it takes an extra week or an extra month to write the regulation, to get it right, the benefits to the market in the long run far exceed that little bit of time.
But it's hard to get the job done in part because Republicans in Congress have blocked financial agencies from staffing up. Supporters of Dodd-Frank say the delaying tactics are designed to run out the clock until the 2012 elections, then get financial reform revisited. Lawrence Baxter says that'd be a mistake.
Instability is lurking all the time, and if another big bank goes down, I think you will see a much bigger public reaction.
With another round of financial panic, a huge credit crunch, and the economy tanking all over again. Baxter says if the banks think they're heavily regulated now, just wait. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Prepaid debit cards get a pretty bad rap, mostly because they're loaded with fees. Fees to get the card, to use the card, to close the card. Today, American Express announced a prepaid card that eliminates almost all of those fees. Why? Would you believe fees? Marketplace's Jennifer Collins has the story.
Prepaid debit cards are a $60 billion industry. The main reason why?
I can only spend the money I have on the card, so I'm in control.
Of everything but the fees, which can add up fast. Most prepaid debit card users tend to be low income, have poor credit, and limited banking options. Todd Zwicky, a professor at George Mason University, says the new Amex card could change the game.
What we might be seeing is a real renaissance in the prepaid card industry as more mainstream consumers shift away from traditional debit cards to these prepaid cards.
Amex's card isn't fee-free. There are charges for multiple ATM use and loading the card with cash instead of, say, your checking account. But the fees are still lower than other prepaid cards. Ron Shevlin is an analyst with ITE Group.
They lend a whole lot of credibility to the prepaid card space just by coming into the market with this kind of announcement.
Shevlin says Amex's strategy is to make money by collecting so-called interchange fees, which merchants pay every time you swipe the card. And the company also collects twice, says Josh Frank of the Center for Responsible Lending.
Because they both own the payment network and issue cards, they can get the money that for other card issuers would go elsewhere.
And in a market that's expected to nearly double in the next 4 years, he says more banks are expected to follow Amex into the prepaid pool. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
One other bit of macroeconomic news before we move on from the chairman of the Federal Reserve this time. At a budget conference in Washington today, Ben Bernanke tried once again to persuade Congress that the debt limit isn't really a moving target. It's the wrong tool, he said, to use to control the budget deficit. The head of the Congressional Budget Office, by the way, Doug Elmendorf, said the same thing today, separately. On Wall Street on this Tuesday, traders got their mojo back. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This being a mostly free market economy, a company's got to do what it's got to do to satisfy shareholders and maintain the bottom line. So Miracle-Gro, the plant fertilizer people, have decided they want to do more than just help everyday gardeners grow happier marigolds and bigger tomatoes. The company is eyeing another market, this one that is booming. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Adrian Hill reports.
Let's be blunt. Scotts Miracle-Gro seems to have high expectations for the medical marijuana market. The CEO of the fertilizer company told the Wall Street Journal, quote, "I want to target the pot market." Now the company's tone has mellowed a bit. A press officer sent a statement saying the medical marijuana market is one of many niche markets the company might explore. But why would a company associated with prize-winning tomatoes even consider hanging around with the stoner crowd? Money, my friends. Big money.
We're estimating that the 2011 market for medical marijuana will be $1.7 billion.
Chris Lotlicker heads Sea Change Strategy, a data analysis firm. He estimates the legal marijuana market will double in the next 5 years and expects all sorts of legitimate companies will start getting comfortable with marijuana. Mark Kleinman is a public policy professor at UCLA and author of a new book, Drugs and Drug Policy.
The fact that the company is now prepared to come out front and say, okay, we want to market to this group, suggests that it's not as scary to them as it used to be.
Kleinman says it's one sign that public opinion has moved faster than federal policy, and it has the potential to continue changing opinion.
If you see respectable companies doing something, well, that sort of changes your view about what it's about.
The real question? How to avoid confusion among customers when you're selling chemicals meant to kill weeds and chemicals meant to grow weed. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
The biopharmacological benefits of Miracle-Gro on domestic medical marijuana crops aside, a good portion of the illegal drugs in this country come over the Mexican border. Once they get here, the first step is usually a stash house someplace in a city like Phoenix or San Diego. Smugglers then pick up smaller loads for wider delivery, and they have a convenient pipeline to do that, the interstate highway system. Today we continue our series, The Drug War at Home, from Fronteras. It's a regional reporting project in the Southwest. Jude Joffe Block reports on the hunt for illegal drugs on American highways.
Lieutenant Lazaro Chavez oversees a team that intercepts drugs smuggled in from Mexico. But Chavez isn't anywhere near the border. He works 300 miles away for the Las Vegas Metro Police Department.
This is the battleground for us, right here, Interstate 15.
I-15 starts in San Diego, passes by the Mojave Desert, through Las Vegas, and onto Salt Lake City, where it heads north.
This is the road that the cartels have identified as their route.
The federal government chips in $3 million annually to fight drugs in southern Nevada. It's one of 28 zones throughout the country that gets federal support as so-called high-intensity drug trafficking areas.
3-10-4, are you available?
Chavez and his team drive unmarked cars.
It's almost like a big chess game. So we figure out, how are they doing it today? Are they using a semi? Are they using buses? Maybe they're using hidden compartments inside cars.
Various law enforcement agencies share intelligence, which helps Chavez and his team track down suspicious vehicles. They also look out for models known to have good hiding spots for drugs. One example, behind the dashboard of the newer Volkswagen Beetle. But the only constant in this game is that the traffickers' techniques are always advancing.
They are putting forth every effort that they can to train their drivers, to provide them with security vehicles to escort them through the United States.
You'd think the price for drugs would go up the farther they travel. That is true for marijuana, but the most expensive drugs, cocaine, heroin, and methamphetamines, aren't like typical cargo. Take cocaine, which could be worth around $6,000 per pound at the wholesale price.
It's very hard to think of any other normal commodity that costs anywhere near that much per unit weight.
Professor Jonathan Calkins researches drug markets at Carnegie Mellon University. He points out that $300,000 worth of cocaine at wholesale price can fit in just a 50-pound suitcase.
So if you had two people spend a week driving that cocaine from the southwest border all the way to New York City, still, the cost of labor, the cost of gasoline, they're really round-off error.
Of course, there's the risk of being caught. But Calkins says drug traffickers calculate the real risky part to be the sale, not the drive. Each transaction is a chance to be busted by the cops or robbed, and that drives up the price. Calkins says that's why the street price of cocaine can be 8 times the wholesale price.
You see big differences in the price as a function of the number of transactions since the drugs entered the country, but there aren't big differences as a function just of the number of miles away from the border.
From law enforcement's perspective, they want to intercept those drugs as early as possible in the chain, before the loads have been divvied up.
Once it gets to its location, you're not going to get it all.
Kent Bitsko directs Nevada's high-intensity drug trafficking area task force. But he says if they do find drugs in a car, it's becoming less common for the drivers to cooperate and become informants.
They're not very willing to talk because they're afraid of the cartels. They're a lot more afraid of what will happen to them if they cross the cartels than what will happen to them going to prison here.
Those informants are key to dismantling drug trafficking organizations. And right now, the traffickers seem to be succeeding. They're still able to get their product to consumers and make money. Back on the highway, Lieutenant Chavez says he takes it personally when he finds out about large loads of drugs that make it into the city.
You find 50 pounds or 100 pounds of methamphetamine, and you know that there's only one way it could have gotten here.
And that's on the highway, probably on Interstate 15. In Las Vegas, I'm Jude Joffe Block for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, in part 3 of our series, 22 million Americans use illegal drugs every year. How much blame do they deserve for the Mexican drug wars? Coming up.
In the 1980s, the average young college-educated mother spent 13 hours per week on childcare. Now it's 22 hours a week.
So does more time equal more successful children? The Freakonomics of parenting. But first, yeah, let's do the numbers. There was some good news on Wall Street for a change today. The Dow Industrials bounced up 123 points, just over 1%, closed at 12,076. The NASDAQ added 39 points, about 1.5%, 2,678 the number there. The S&P 500 reeled in 16 points, about 1.25%, wrapped up trading at 1,287. One reason for that optimism, retail sales slipped last month, but less than analysts had predicted. For investors, retailer JCPenney was definitely in their thoughts. Shares shined up about 17.5% today after the department store chain said its next CEO is going to be the guy who pioneered the Apple retail store. Apple shares chomped up 1.75% today. Shares of Best Buy got 4.5% better. First quarter earnings fell but beat expectations. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.1%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill, an international producer and marketer of food, agricultural, financial, and industrial products and services. Information at Cargill.com. And by Manta, connecting millions of small business owners and new customers every day on the web at Manta.com. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Farmers Insurance, trained local agents committed to small business success. More at 1-866-200-4BIZ. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve reports on industrial production for May. Are consumers experiencing inflation in their day-to-day living expenses? The Labor Department releases its monthly Consumer Price Index. And a 3-day conference focusing on traumatic brain injury wraps up in Washington. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. That's APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. The ILO, the International Labor Organization, is holding its annual meeting in Switzerland this week. It is the 100th such gathering for the UN agency. One of the things it's working on is a new set of labor standards for domestic workers, nannies and housekeepers and caregivers for the elderly, women mostly, undocumented immigrants often, a vulnerable and isolated workforce almost always. So there's a push on for an international treaty to protect them, and organized labor here in the U.S. has a similar idea, as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler explains.
Sitting in her apartment in Los Angeles, 52-year-old Frida Inahosa isn't afraid to speak out. She's a U.S. citizen now. But when she came here 20 years ago as an undocumented immigrant, she was too scared to protest the living conditions provided by her employer.
She had a trailer in her backyard, and she had 8 dogs. And I arrived early in the winter when it was cold. My boss sent me to sleep with the dogs, so I did. I slept with the dogs.
Inahosa is a domestic worker. Her job is part nanny, part maid. She says employers can seem like nice people in public.
Once you close the door, it's a different story. Domestic workers suffer verbal abuses, physical abuses, emotional abuses.
Once, Inahosa was injured while taking care of a child, so she told her boss.
When I explained what happened, my employer said she didn't believe me and fired me unjustly.
Historically, unions have organized workers like Frida Inahosa, but under U.S. labor laws, domestic workers are excluded from unionizing. Ana Avendano is with the AFL-CIO.
Domestic workers are not protected either by wage and hour laws or by the laws that guaranteed workers the right to bargain collectively. So that means that nannies have no real mechanism to improve their wages and working conditions.
At the International Labor Organization in Geneva this week, the unions have used their influence to make domestic workers a priority. By the end of the week, the ILO is expected to announce new minimum labor standards for domestic workers. But the AFL-CIO's Avendano says that may not have much impact here in the U.S.
The irony here is that the United States doesn't even guarantee those minimum standards.
It might seem odd that labor would invest time and money on people who are currently prevented by law from becoming union members. Abel Valenzuela is a Chicano studies professor at UCLA.
I think this is really an important new direction that the AFL-CIO should be taking if they want to exist, I think, as a relevant entity.
Valenzuela says undocumented immigrants working below the radar make good prospective union members.
We're literally talking about hundreds of thousands of potential members, so it's smart strategy on their part.
Advocacy groups like the National Domestic Workers Alliance recently partnered with unions to establish labor standards in New York State. Nanny and house cleaner Frida Hinojosa is working on a similar campaign in California.
That's what we're fighting for a Bill of Rights, so we'll be protected by labor laws.
But until the law changes, she'll work with immigrant groups that have banded together outside of organized labor. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Time now for a little Freakonomics Radio. It's that moment every couple of weeks where we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name, about the hidden side of everything. Dubner, good to talk to you.
Hey, you too, Kai. Happy summer. My kids are already out of school. How about yours?
Two more days.
All right, so I'm curious what a guy like you puts your kids through during the summer. I sent you a little checklist. So I was just curious.
So
you want to take a look at that?
Yeah, it's not a bad list. So museums. No, we will not be doing museums because that makes me do work. There will be some baseball. There will be some singing lessons. There will be tennis and language and lots of swimming because it's L.A. in the summertime.
That's pretty busy. Now, you are not alone, I'm happy to say, in spending a lot of time with your kids. Check out this message from Valerie Ramey, who's an economist at the University of California, San Diego, who looked into how modern parents are spending their time.
In the 1980s, the average young college-educated mother spent 13 hours per week on childcare. Now it's 22 hours a week. Now what's interesting is over this same time period, the wages of college-educated women have really increased. So the opportunity cost of time has increased. At the same time, they've decided to spend more time taking care of their children.
So that's like what, 13 to 22 is like 9 hours. It's like what, 75-ish%? What are the mothers doing with that time, though, Dubner?
Well, it's interesting. You know, you got a lot of opportunities, you got a lot of work, and what a lot of these high-end mothers are doing is chauffeuring their kids around to things like music lessons and fencing lessons and horseback riding. Valerie Ramey, some of it's for fun, obviously, but yeah. Valerie Ramey calls it the rugrat race. Her argument is that kids have to work harder to get into good colleges these days, and therefore their parents enable them by pushing them toward all these extracurricular activities that are going to look good on a college application.
Which, you know, on the face of it sounds reasonable, but really is kind of ridiculous and painful.
Right? Well, you know, I think it has to do with parents thinking of their children as investment vehicles a little bit, right? Because that's what we think about. We want to invest in them so that they will pay off, whether for themselves or for us,
okay,
right?
All right. Yep.
Let me let you hear from a different economist. His name is Bruce Sacerdote. He's at Dartmouth. He wanted to know how much this kind of activist parenting, if you want to call it that, actually pays off. And one way to measure this, especially if you're talking about educational achievement, which is what parents probably care about the most, is to look at adoption studies where you can actually measure the impact that a family, that the parents will have on a kid.
So what's his thesis? That kids adopted into, I guess, high education homes will be more likely to go to college? Is that the deal?
Exactly right. If parents are so important, then parents can take an adopted kid who might otherwise not have gone to college, and that kid will become college material.
Okay.
So Sacerdote sliced and diced a lot of good data, and he did find parental influence.
But it's not quite as big as I expected to find.
Yeah, all right, so quantify for me. How big is not so big?
If you're a child who's adopted into a high education family, that is where the parents both went to college, right? You are about 16 percentage points more likely to go to college than a kid who gets adopted into a low education family.
Okay.
So that sounds pretty good, okay? Until you compare that to the rate for biological kids from high education families who are about 75 percentage points more likely to go to college than biological kids from low education families. So On the one hand, this is a little dispiriting for parents. We don't seem to have as much influence as we might think. On the other hand, in a weird way, it kind of takes some of the pressure off, right? At least it did for Bruce Sacerdote.
This notion that genes are really important and that kids are hardwired to do certain things, I think understanding that did help me relax and not worry so much that I was going to, quote unquote, screw them up in some terrible way.
Yeah, OK, so that's a good thought. But I have two observations to make. The first, as an adoptive parent, and maybe this says more about me than about Sacerdote's numbers, but it is 100% likely that my adopted daughter is going to go to college, just like my biological boys. So that's, you know, that I guess probably talks about me. But the other one is there is more to measuring the success of parenting and the resulting children than where they go to college or even if they go to college at all, Dubner.
Absolutely. There's, you know, love and happiness and satisfaction, all that good stuff. But here's the thing. The data seem to suggest that a lot of parents who get wrapped up in activist parenting who push their kids toward accomplishment might actually make themselves unhappy as parents and might end up sacrificing some of that good stuff. So that's really the balance. If you want to go off the balance, you might even consider the opposite end of the spectrum, the style embraced by my Freakonomics friend and co-author Steve Levitt.
Most of them just lazy. You know, I could be investing in the kids or I could be, you know, indulging my own, you know, hobbies and sleeping and things. And so I'm sort of lazy. I mean, the other problem I have is I have four kids. If you have too many kids, you can't invest that heavily in any one of them because you go crazy.
Amen, brother. If it's good enough for Stephen Levitt, it's good enough for me. That's all I have to say.
Hey, have a nice lazy Father's Day, Kai, huh?
I will do that. You too. Stephen Dubner, freakonomicsradio.com is his website. We'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Thanks, Kai.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Reputation.com, monitoring, protecting, and improving reputations online while deleting personal data from the Internet. Reputation.com. Marketplace is supported by IBM, working to help mid-sized businesses become the engines of a smarter planet. Learn more at ibm.com/engines. And by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today in which I lose out to Samuel L. Jackson. You remember a couple of weeks ago I read from the runaway kids' book bestseller Go the Bleep to Sleep? Well, it turns out the publishers have passed me over for the audiobook version. Jackson's going to do it, which is fine and all. I get it. Public radio guy versus movie star. But it does kind of raise this question. What parent in their right mind is going to have Samuel L. Jackson read their kid to sleep? I mean, that's like a recipe for a nightmare right there. All right, that's Marketplace from APM American Public Media this Tuesday. Today, the Dow bounced up 123 points, just over 1%. The NASDAQ added 39 points, about 1.5%. The S&P 500, Wyatt, gained 16 points, about 1.25%. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abeed, and that is what you ought to listen to every morning for the latest in business and economic news. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you back here tomorrow, same time, same channel. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.